Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Hello and welcome everyone to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor podcast. I'm joined not only by our wonderful listeners, but also our wonderful co-hosts, Kate Bakos and Dave Johnston. Kate, how are you today?
I'm well, thanks, Pete, and I'm loving this episode. I get excited when our listeners send in questions, and we can pre-record this because our answers are our answers, and you're enjoying some sun in the Middle East as we go to air. Yeah.
So, very exciting being able to take a group of students over to the UAE to do a real-life case study on property development. One of the great advantages of being a lecturer.
Very exciting. And while you're doing that, I'll be playing with brand new kittens.
Our kittens are
home. I know, I've been showing everyone. I'm so excited. Dave, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well, Kate. Yeah, enjoying back being on terra firma in Australia after the trip to Nepal. And, yeah, this beautiful weather. And this is being pre-recorded, as you mentioned.
So you're still jet-lagged.
Still jet-lagged because it's back-to-back after the market update. Looking forward to taking the kids to the 2020 World Cup final.
Going to some friends on Sunday.
To the Australia.
The sport.
Naughty. Flipped that in. I suppose I've talked about kittens, so I'll forgive you.
No, exactly. Yeah. I went there once you were talking about kittens. So I thought it was only fair. The kids were so disappointed when Australia-England got washed out with our horrible weather of a couple of weeks ago.
I just got a text message saying that your cat playpen is due for delivery. We love hearing from our listeners and we'd love to tackle more of your questions. So please, if you have any on your mind, no matter how great or small, send us a message. You can email us info@propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com. Or go to our website, Facebook page, or simply click on the link in your podcast app under the play button and fill out our online form.
All right, let's get into our list of questions, shall we? One of the more popular podcasts we have, along with our property market updates. Three questions. Hi, Pete, Kate, and Dave. I'm a reasonably seasoned investor and have accumulated three properties over the years. I generally agree with the same investment philosophy of what is discussed on your podcast. I try to aim for a suburb that is either close to the city or the beach, select a property with high land to asset value, buying the worst house on the best street of the suburb, etc. Excellent. So far, so good. The logic is that with good selection of a property with these characteristics would help us outperform the average property investment. However, there are property experts who have back-tested different properties, so-called A-grade blue chip versus C-grade duds, and found that outperformance is rarely observed in these A-grade blue chip properties. These experts also debunk myths like amenities, lifestyle factors, proximity to the city and beaches matter. They say that it is true that these properties are worth more, but they've always been so since inception and not due to outperforming growth. Whether a property is worth more today or not does not mean the same property will outperform at a greater rate than a cheaper property. This is because the property started at a higher base. They will always be more expensive and appear to be a better investment, even if the growth is more modest than a cheaper property. This makes sense because if a location is desirable because it's close to the beach or the city, this is a known factor from day one and therefore already priced in. Instead, they recommend looking at specific data sets such as auction clearance rates, percentage of listings, online search interest, percentage vacancy rate, percentage owner occupiers, and track this trend for all suburbs over time and claim that they are able to predict suburbs that are likely to boom in the short term. They also admit they can't predict what will happen in the long term, but that they can fairly accurately predict which suburbs are likely to boom in a 3 to 5 year horizon by their trend analysis. Are these metrics something you guys look at when selecting a good quality investment property? And do you agree with this approach or found that the traditional approach is more reliable? Say, for example, if the metrics analysed indicates that a suburb like Clyde in Victoria is about to boom, and even if you have a budget to secure a nice investment in the best street of Camberwell, would you rather buy 2 to 3 properties in Clyde over a nice blue chip property in Camberwell? Thanks, guys. Appreciate your efforts on the podcast. My God, that was a very, very long
question. Great question. Really well considered.
Great question. But a
good one.
And Peter knows his stuff.
All right, who wants to kick us off?
Kate can.
Awesome. There is so much to this, and I will answer it. I read it and thought, what a ripping question to tackle. When you're investing, you're not just looking for capital growth. However, some investors might, but everyone has their own strategy, and it ultimately comes down to your cash flows and your retirement plan. So are you holding these properties into perpetuity? Are you looking at divesting them and having a gain and reinvesting? Are you looking at being an active or a passive investor? Do you want to improve the property? Do annoying tenants give you a headache? A vacancy is a bit of a concern. Lots of moving parts. But once you've identified what's important to you, I think what Peter's really asking about and focusing on is capital growth. And we're talking about the question of whether a rising tide floats all ships, or whether paying that premium at the start doesn't, it gives you a false sense of growth. And what I want to do is talk about the three different types of capital growth that we typically find, because capital growth isn't always just blue chip, because it's a great area with rising household incomes and lots of appetite for the area. Another type of growth is social. So we've just been through COVID and such a shakeup, and I'll use this example shortly. The third one is gentrification. And Pete, you've talked about this a lot on the show. So when someone asks an expert, like any of us, what's a hotspot? We've got to define what sort of hotspotting we're looking for. What are the growth drivers, and what type of capital growth change are we trying to identify? Is it gentrification, or are we picking social change? And the two are quite different. And sometimes with social change, it can be something like COVID that was unexpected. So they're the harder ones to pick. However, if I circle back to the question, and I go to, let's say, a data bank of data that's longer term. So valuer general, you can easily pull off the internet, 10 years worth of data. But the problem that I have with this 10 years worth of data is that it's been so skewed by some of the crazy results that we've had through COVID. If I picked this chart 3 years ago, it would look completely different. So, for example, if I grab houses over 10 years, I would have expected, you know, the Albert Parks, the Middle Parks, and apologies to our listeners who aren't familiar with Victoria because that's my state, but I'm picking the really blue chip suburbs that have the highest land value per square metre. We always expected to see them soaring. And if I use a short little example here, just I'm still in the A's on the alphabet. Elphington, for example, 10 years year-on-year growth for houses, 8.8%. By anyone's measure, that's good. But if we look at Armstrong's Creek, which is a new estate in Geelong, or if we look at Aries Inlet, which is coastal on the Surf Coast, we've got 10.1 for Aries and 12.4 for Armstrong Creek. Now, Armstrong Creek is skewing things because it's house and land. We have to bear that in mind. You're looking at land releases versus completed house and dwelling. My point here is, though, COVID's changed all of that. So what are we looking for? Are we hotspotting based on gentrification, based on social change, or based on blue chip? And if we look at all of the suburbs outside of the coastal and the COVID type escape areas, what I can say is that the inner ring and the established areas with the higher land value per square metre, they do outperform. Sorry, that was so long.
That's a long question, deserved a long answer. How about you? Does.
Yeah, look, I agree with Kate. So I think the further you go back in time, the less the data supports the hypothesis that he makes or some of the companies make. You can look at property so many different ways. So that doesn't mean that there isn't going to be some, potentially some truth where some of the properties in some of those markets with some of those suburbs are going to outperform in the next 5 years. And therefore, if you get into one of those properties in the next, you know, 1 to 5 years, or probably 1 to 3 years, you're going to get more capital growth up front. and then it'll even out. And so over the long term, you might do a little bit better or as well as if you got into what we would consider an A-grade location. So, but then it also comes back to the individual buyer. What is the right price point for you? What can you afford? Because you've always got to marry up the price point that's right for you today with the best location. The next point I would make is, as a general rule, I'm a believer in when you're ready to invest, purchasing towards the top end of the price point that you can afford. So that leans it again to more of a blue chip location subject to your affordability. Why do I believe that? Because all things being equal, the more money you put into the market because of the power of compound growth, the greater your return's going to be over the long term, because we know how your returns compound the longer you hold an asset and how you get much greater capital growth years 10 to 20, then 0 to 10 and 20 to 30. So therefore, if you get a higher value purchase at the start rather than a lower value, which this type of location infers, you're going to make more money. So that's another reason to look at the best quality location and property. Another reason too is the higher you go up the income curve, the more free cash flow people tend to have. So what that means is they have more cash flow to put towards property and overexpend relative to the lower end of the income curve as well. So the blue chip locations have the ability for people to spend more. We know people spend more on owner-occupied properties because of the lifestyle drivers. Two-thirds of the property market is owner-occupied. So these are a number of the reasons why I think getting into the blue chip locations, all things being equal and you're picking the right street in the right property, you don't have to make as many property decisions. There's not a delay in property decision, making multiple ones for lower values. You have less headaches as an owner as well because you don't have to own as many properties over the long term. So these are a number of the reasons. And then the long-term stats also back it up in terms of the capital growth, as Kate articulated. So they are some of the reasons. But again, it comes down to your own affordability, and ultimately your affordability will drive the location and asset type that's right for you.
Thanks, Kate and Dave. But before we round that off, I'd like to throw in my 5 cents worth. And mine's boiled down to four words: show me the money. So when you talk about experts that reckon that they can predict suburbs, ask them, well, show me your previous predictions and how they performed. Because unfortunately, I've seen far too many so-called experts saying, oh, you know, this is going to do well, this is going to do well. But, you know, nobody really goes back to check how their previous predictions went. So if you listen to the show, you know what I and Kate and Dave have to say about buying property. And you can test my predictions. If you get a copy of my first book, Top Australian Suburbs, which I wrote in 2008, you can probably buy it very cheaply on Google Books or Amazon Books. And you'll see there's 107 suburbs that I picked. And each one has its median house price and median unit price. Grab yourself a property magazine that has the current median house price in particular rather than unit price for those suburbs, and see how my predictions went based on my criteria, which is close to the city, close to the sea, consider gentrification, consider urban renewal. Now, that's just a very rough guide how to test predictions, because when I test them, I refine the data a little bit more. Like, my starting point is 2008. So when I filter the data, I won't have any properties that were built after 2008. Because what I'm trying to show people is, well, you should have bought in this suburb in 2008, because now you would have made so much money. But if the house didn't actually exist in 2008, well, that's not really fair. And often, you know, new properties sell at a premium because you've got that developer's profit when it's first sold. I would suggest, again, check out these so-called experts' past predictions, because there is more than one way to skin the property cat. You find out which property experts align with your thinking and go for it. But in the end, you need to buy something. You know, you need... Sometimes there's just too much analysis paralysis. You just need to buy something decent.
I love that answer, Pete. Show me the money. Peter did ask a couple of questions, and I'm happy to answer. And I think this stands for all of us. You know, do you look at percentage listings, online search interest, percentage vacancy, percentage owner occupiers? Of course we do. But as we know, data can change a lot. It can be very, very static. It can be quite volatile. Peter asked, can we pick something that will boom in a 3 to 5 year horizon? And Pete, you're probably the best person to talk to this, but everybody wants me to pick them a property that in 3 to 5 years will do well. And honestly, I want to as well, because it's nice for a client to see immediate growth increase. It's very exciting, and it's also likely to have them feel more confident about their strategy and hold the property for longer. But that shouldn't be the holy grail. I could pick a property that might do something exciting in 3 years, but I don't want it then to languish. And when you look at hot spotting in localized areas with lower population levels and performance that is dictated by one industry, that can be really dangerous. I mean, we can talk about some mining towns and have a look at some horror stories in the recent past and use those as key cases for not chasing hot spots. Gentrification, different story altogether. And what I will say is the data will tell you what will gentrify. If you're starting to see it, if you're starting to see cool cafes, it's already gentrifying. You say it, Pete, you've got bikes and pubs and craft beer.
Was it ABC, alcohols, bikes and coffee?
Yeah. Well, once that's happening, it's already started to gentrify. Yep, you can jump on the wave and keep cruising it. But if you want to get in before that happens, if you walk around the suburb, you won't be feeling like it's groovy and you won't be feeling super excited. You might feel unsafe. But if the data is telling you that the demographic is changing, then that's certainly a leading indicator. And that is something I take very seriously. And I can talk about all kinds of suburbs that have delivered that I can point to and be really proud of, but it takes a lot of research. And I think I wouldn't just circle in on proximity to water or proximity to city. There are other things, but you've said that as well, Pete, you know, developmental change and social change. I think it goes beyond looking at data that can jump around like vacancy rates and things like that. If you're wanting to hotspot, you've really got to identify, are you looking for something that will perform well long-term or something that's a flash in the pan for a little while?
Yeah, and look, I think like with any marketplace or group or profession, there's some people who are really good at what they do and there's some people who are not so good. And that goes in this space as well. There are some people who are great with data and perhaps are more likely than not to be able to pick some of the trends that are likely to occur over the next 1 to 5 years. But there's also been a proliferation of property advisors who have jumped on board, probably the regional boom that's occurred during COVID and are now really driving a lot of buyers into certain locations that show very good short-term statistics. And I think we're going to see particularly a lot, number of smaller regional locations around the country and particularly on the eastern seaboard, you know, that are going to flatline or worse for a long period of time, like what we saw with a number of mining towns. So I just think you need to be very careful with the decisions you're making. And you've mentioned this, the suburb of Clyde, which is on the sort of the outer southern east suburbs. Personally, that isn't a suburb I'd be putting my money in or sending any clients to.
Me neither. It's house and land central. So you've got a lot of green space around you. We've talked in the past about potential growth being hampered by the availability of new builds with incentives.
I don't try and forecast suburbs for 3 to 5 years because most people are going to hold on to it for much longer than that. And if you listen to a previous podcast, which if you're a long time listener, you probably listened to it already, but maybe go back and listen to it. It's timing the market versus time in the market. So over a 15-year period, I looked at what would happen if you just bought a house in each of the capital cities and sat on it for 15 years. And then I looked at, well, if you bought something every 5 years, how would it perform? And so because there's 8 capital cities, 8 times 8 is 64, 64 times 8 is, I don't know, close to 500. So there's 500 different outcomes, right?
I was waiting for it.
About 500 different outcomes. If you bought, even if you bought in the best performing capital city for 5 years and then bought in the next best performing capital city for 5 years and then the next one, by the time you add buying and selling costs, capital gains tax, in the vast majority of cases, you were just better off buying and holding. So even if you could predict short-term winners, because the buying and selling of property is so expensive, it's just not worth it. You're much better off buying a great quality asset that's going to do well over the long term, have the patience and sit on it.
And get more money into the market while you can. Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about
on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
Next question. We would like some advice about our investment property, which has not seen much growth since we purchased it 11 years ago. We would be interested in your thoughts on whether we should preserve with its slow growth and keep it, or just bite the bullet and sell and invest our money in another property, which will provide more growth. So the background is, my husband's 43, I'm 38, purchased this property in April 2011. It's a two-bedroom unit, one bathroom, one car park for $533,000 in St Kilda, Melbourne. It's one in a block of 10, built in the 1960s. We lived in the property for about 4 years, then rented a bigger place while we had our two daughters and purchased our current family home in 2020. So the rental return on the investment property has taken a hit with COVID, and we are currently receiving $1,800 per month. In May of this year, we were advised by an agent that the property would be worth between $565 and $585. Appreciate any insights you have. We feel disappointed with the growth of the property and are not sure what to do. So basically, It's do you cut your losses and move on, or do we hold in there? What do you reckon, Dave?
Look, it's an interesting one. I mean, I'll open up to our listeners. When I started the business, we had buyer's agents for about 8 years in the business, and before most people knew what buyer's agents were, and before a lot of the buyer's agents who are around nowadays even existed. And we certainly bought a number of established units for a lot of our clients. And unfortunately, a number of them haven't performed as well as we would have liked. Now, the historical numbers over the previous 40 to 50 years was really strong. So established units in good locations had performed as well as good quality established housing. But with the proliferation of new apartments, there's actually, unfortunately, these types of units have probably, because they don't have as many options in terms of pools, they're not quite as shiny, they, you know, perhaps don't have views, which you can get in some of the apartments, they haven't really done as well over the last 10 to 15 years. Now, there's been a number of, you know, very reputable buyer's agents who have been talking again about how they think it's the time to get back into established units. I think in the long run, they will come to the fore and really be pronounced, but obviously we need even more medium to high density apartments before they really stand out as beacons of light in comparison to the medium to high density apartments around them. You know, they need to be spacious. They need to have big rooms. This has a car park on title, which is always very important. Its own bedroom. I think two bedrooms is necessary versus one bedroom now, with working from home being much more prevalent. So, but then I'd bring it back to your own situation. Is it positive cash flow? If it's already positive cash flow, you're probably not going to increase your borrowing capacity a great deal. I don't know how much savings you're going to get from the sale. And I'm still a believer that these will be reasonable performers in the long term, as I've just said. But look, unfortunately, over the last decade or so, they haven't been the best performers.
Well said, Dave. Look, Melbourne's very different to a lot of other cities and capital cities for that matter. I mean, Sydney's more of an apartment-centric city because you've got a lot more buildings, low-density buildings offering beautiful views. And we've also been a city that's got a bit excited about our own house or our own unit on its own block of land as opposed to strata. For some funny reason, Melburnians don't always get excited about owners corporation or what used to be body corporate. All that aside though, Dave's point is right. 25 years ago, apartments were outperforming houses in these suburbs, and a lot of reputable buyers agencies, for whatever reason, circled in on these really nice areas. And I want to go back to the point that I make about the reasons, the things that investors should be mindful of: you've got capital growth, rental yield, vacancy rates, and the type of tenant. Now, if you want a professional tenant or a tenant that, by any other description, is less likely to have affordability issues with their rent and maybe less issues as a tenant that give a landlord a bit of a headache, these areas usually deliver. You'll get a good tenant who will appreciate the property. We have had vacancy rates become problematic, and then COVID shook everything up in Melbourne. And for this listener, that particular rent, it's circa early fours, 400 a week. It shouldn't be that for this unit. It should be closer to 430 to 440. So that will improve. The pain of COVID is going to start to fade for some investors that were caught in that issue in the inner suburbs of Melbourne. But the real question is, do you hold it or do you sell it? And that comes down to what's your motivation for having it. If this is a property that you'd like a non-troublesome tenant to pay a decent rent all the way through into your retirement and you'll hold it and keep it or maybe have it for your kids to use, I don't know, then you've got to assess whether the emotional reasons for holding it are stronger than the financial reasons for looking for gain. But if you bought it for capital growth and that's what you need, and I look at your ages and I think, well, you've still got a lot of time on your side, you might make the decision to get out of it and go and buy something that will give you more proven capital growth. And it's fair to say, if we look at and not just short-term or medium-term, but longer-term data now, houses do outperform units. But you have to bear in mind your rental position will change, your rental yield will change, and you might wind up with some negative cash flow. So I would be talking to a planner before you make a decision.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Kate, and also thank you, Dave. All right, so, well, thank you very much for those answers, Kate and Dave. So just the two questions today from our listeners, and thanks once again, listeners. But please don't go away because we have our gold nuggets.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
So, Dave, what's your gold nugget?
So my gold nugget is how to address whether you should hold or sell an existing property. So basically, the key points it boils down to is, number one, assess the quality of the asset. What's the long-term capital growth plus the rental return yield? So what is your gross return on the asset? How does that stack up against the marketplace? Number two, is the cash flow on the property already neutrally geared or even positively geared? Because if it is, there's usually much less of an upside from selling. How much cash will you get from the sale and how much will your borrowing capacity change? Because those two points then flow into what can you actually purchase with your money and your borrowing power if you were to sell. So one, what's the quality of the asset? Two, is it negatively geared, neutrally geared, or positively geared? If it's already positive or neutrally geared, there's less of a case to sell. And then three, what can you actually do with the money due to the cash from the sale and the borrowing capacity change? What is your actual price point and what type of quality asset can you purchase to replace the one you've sold? You really need to go through those three key assessment points to be able to determine whether or not your existing property is worth holding or selling.
Thank you, Dave. Kate, your gold nugget?
For anyone, any investor out there that was impacted by the difficulties in COVID of getting a tenant in the property, and for those who had to drop their rents dramatically or offer longer terms, if you're looking at your property and looking at your balance sheet and your profit and loss statement and saying to yourself, the rent is just so low and it's not worth it, make sure you do chat to your property manager and get a really good evaluation of what the going rate is now, because a lot of people don't keep an eye on it and they're out of sync or out of touch with the going rents. And I know we spoke last week about, you know, our market update and how difficult it is for tenants. And so it pains me to say this, but I'm talking as an investor. If you're looking at a property and feeling like it's underperforming rent-wise for you, make sure you get an up-to-date analysis or assessment. And if your property manager's not giving you some data or some comparable rentals, go to one who will.
Excellent. Some great tips there from Kate and Dave. Thank you, listeners, for your time once again. And we look forward to having your company next week.
I'll miss you guys. Have a safe trip, Pete.
Have a great trip, Pete. See you in
See you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi there, it's Anne-Marie from Property Planning Australia here. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about some of the topics discussed, take a listen to episodes number 14, How to Choose a Location for Investment, What to Look For and What to Avoid. Episode 19, Time in the Market versus Timing the Market. Episode 53, Diversification 101, How and Why to Plan for Diversification Within Your Property Portfolio. episode 89, Capital Growth, What Increases Property Value? And episode 169, Houses versus Units, Capital Growth Performance in Capital Cities and Regions over the last 20 years, and which locations have units outperformed houses and why?
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.